Welcome to a pared down reading episode of Art and Labor. I'm Lucia Love, and I'm here with my co-host, a book. Okay is currently indisposed while dealing with a heated battle against the land-owning class. So I'm just bringing you guys a little piece of reading from Byung-Chul Han, Topology of Violence, so that y'all can, chew on something that's not the news. A little bit about this theorist. They've been working a lot with the concept of self-exploitation that occurs within the more increasingly technological societies that turn everyone into, someone who holds the means of production as themselves. Some of his key quotes are, when production is immaterial, everyone already owns the means of production. The neoliberal system is no longer a class system in the proper sense. It does not consist of classes that display mutual antagonism. This is what accounts for the system's stability. And, today, everyone is an auto-exploiting laborer in his or her own enterprise. People are now master and slave in one. Even class struggle has transformed into an inner struggle against oneself. And from that concept, Han developed the achievement subject, which I've really related to strongly in regards to being kind of a small business entrepreneur type in the art world. And, you know, I guess anybody who's had to do their own correspondence and make their own things and try to argue for the reason why you should exist in the first place in the freelance market can probably relate to this. Especially now, since a lot of people are finding that the pandemic relief response for freelancers has kind of doubled down a lot on 1099 workers and just saying like, hey, you know, if you can't keep working, we don't care. You weren't good enough to receive a W-2, so, and then to be fired, so no relief for you. Anyway, I mean, that's kind of personal, but I guess if you are enjoying some unemployment, you can still access this theory. It's not exclusive. In these dreary times, you know, turn to some revolutionary thinkers that can help you to get your feet underneath you in this topsy-turvy class war that we found ourselves in. Okay, this is a selection from Topology of Violence. Now, here we go. Violence originates not only with overcodification, which raises all free spaces with its rigid repressive order, but also with unbounded decoding and dissolution of boundaries, which releases the world into a flood of undirected events, stimuli, and energies. Coding in itself is not violence. It articulates structures, forms, orders, and verbalizes the world. Only totalitarian over- or hyper-coding is violence. Undoubtedly, a certain decoding can free the world from its compulsions and constraints by working against repressive over-coding. But if it is intensified diabolically, it itself becomes destructive. Deleuze undialectically celebrates unbounded decoding as liberation, masking its diabolic side. Cancerous proliferation, which overruns all organs, nullifying organic difference, is a diabolic form of decoding and deterritorialization. Deleuze's body without organs, in which organic codification has been abolished, hardly differs from a body overrun with metastases. In it, all organic articulation is destroyed, essence is abolished, de-essentialization intensifies into the diabolic. Deleuze's example of the organless body is the schizophrenic table that resembles a heap instead of a table and is divested of all functionality. The tabletop shrinks and then vanishes. It disappears in relation to the framework. Language itself is decoded and undifferentiated into an unarticulated mass of sounds. In order to resist organ machines, the body without organs presents its smooth, slippery, opaque, taut surface as a barrier. In order to resist linked, connected, and interrupted flows, it sets up a counterflow of amorphous, undifferentiated fluid. In order to resist using words composed of articulated phonetic units, it utters only gasps and cries that are sheer, unarticulated blocks of sound. Thus Deleuze's rhizome proliferates out of control. A rhizome has no beginning or end. It is always in the middle, between things, interbeing, intermezzo. The tree is filiation, but the rhizome is alliance, uniquely alliance. The tree imposes the verb to be, but the fabric of the rhizome is the conjunction and. This conjunction carries enough force to shake and uproot the verb to be. Violence isn't merely the repressive neither nor, or the manipulative either or, but also the endless and. The accelerated addition of the same and excessive positivity cause a violent abrogation, which differs from immunological defense because of its positivity. Psychic bulimia doesn't follow the principles of immunity because there is no immune reaction and to or too much. Rather than a deadly infection, infarction is the pathological consequence of the violence of positivity. The limitless addition of the positive may convulse being, but it leads to a proliferation of beings, which is also violence. Deleuze's protagonist is the schizo. As for the schizo continually wandering about, migrating here, there, and everywhere as best he can, he plunges further and further into the realm of deterritorialization, reaching the furthest limits of the decomposition of the socius on the surface of his own body without organs. He scrambles all the codes and is the transmitter of the decoded flows of desire. Deleuze idealizes the schizo to the wanderings of Lenz. A schizophrenic out for a walk is a better model than a neurotic lying on the analyst's couch. Lenz's stroll, for example, as reconstructed by Birchner, everything is a machine. Celestial machines, the stars or rainbows in the sky, alpine machines, all of them connected to those of his body. The continual whir of machines. He does not live nature as nature, but as a process of production. There is no such thing as either man or nature now, only a process that produces the one within the other and couples the machines together. Producing machines, desiring machines, everywhere, schizophrenic machines. The schizo is marked by his ability to rearrange fragments continually in new and different patterns. He possesses a death drive. Deleuze invokes Antonin Artaud. The full body without organs is the unproductive, the sterile, the unengendered, the unconsumable. Antonin Artaud discovered this one day, finding himself with no shape or form whatsoever, right there where he was at that moment. The death instinct that is its name, and death is not without a model. For desire desires death also. Death is its motor, he says of the desiring machine. They sabotage and destroy themselves so that its construction and the beginning of its destruction are indistinguishable. The indistinguishability of construction and destruction, production and devastation, is a characteristic trait of schizophrenic machines, which are very similar to capitalist machines. Schizophrenic production, which fuses with destruction, does not differ meaningfully from unregulated capitalist production. Deleuze even establishes a significant correspondence between schizophrenia and capitalism. The decoding of flows and the deterritorialization of the socius thus constitutes the most characteristic and the most important tendency of capitalism. It continually draws near to its limit, which is a genuinely schizophrenic limit. It tends with all the strength at its command to produce the schizo as the subject of the decoded flows on the body without organs. According to Deleuze, capitalism produces not only schizophrenic traits, but also paranoid ones. It oscillates between deterritorialization and re-territorialization. Deleuze diabolizes only paranoid re-territorialization. He consistently maintains a positive attitude towards schizophrenic deterritorialization. Thus, he suggests heightening the schizophrenic dissolution of boundaries against paranoid re-territorialization. To go still further, that is, in the movement of the market of decoding and deterritorialization, schizophrenic deterritorialization leads to the rhizomatic proliferation of the same, to accumulation of the positive. Violence is not only the negativity of execution or exclusion, but also the positivity of exorbitance and excess. Apparently, violence based on excess positivity isn't visible to Deleuze, and so he celebrates decoding and deterritorialization as liberation, ignoring their other side. The positive violence of excess is more calamitous than the negative violence of deficiency or deprivation. Deficiency naturally comes to an end when the point of saturation is reached, but excess knows no end. Deleuze acquits schizophrenia of any diabolic characteristics. It is largely romanticized and idealized. He speaks of a general and productive schizophrenia that has finally become happy. The schizophrenic desiring machines are compared with Tingley's machines, whose elements are connected to each other without any functional logic. In our present social order, the desiring machine is tolerated only in its perverse forms, which is to say, on the fringes of the serious utilization of machines. But the desiring machines regime is not a generalized perversion. It is rather the opposite, a general and productive schizophrenia that has finally become happy. What Tingley says of one of his own works applies to desiring machines. A truly joyous machine, by joyous I mean free. The deterritorialized system, whose elements communicate with each other despite a lack of any logical function or functioning ties, and which are related to each other despite their lack of relation, this truly joyous system shows no signs of rifts or fissures. Tingley's machines elude all relations of function and purpose, but they form a continuum, a whole that is harmonious within itself. Their parts interlock playfully without any blockages. Somehow they relate. They share a bond of friendship which bestows proximity without relatedness. Because of this inner harmony, they run smoothly. True schizophrenia, in contrast, would cause disruptions and blockages. It is itself a form of compulsion. It makes things neither joyous nor free. Confronted with the negativity of the other, Hegel's spirit develops a paranoid hyper-immunity, which causes hyper-coding and hyper-territorialization. But Deleuze's counter-model of schizophrenic decoding and deterritorialization is also destructive and diabolic. Freed from all negativity, the schizo machine produces violence of positivity. It is like a nuclear reactor that burns out in the wake of uncontrolled chain reactions and overheating. Not all negativity is destructive. Not infrequently, forms of negativity such as hesitation, pausing, boredom, waiting, or rage prove constructive, though they are threatened with disappearance in the course of society's increasing positivization. As we know, computers do not hesitate. They lack the dimension of the other, which makes them autistic calculation machines. Thinking in the emphatic sense is also associated with negativity. Without negativity, thought would just be calculation. The schizophrenic and lacks all negativity and leads to an accumulation of the positive. Only the negativity of a constraint allows cadence, rhythm, indeed time itself, to develop. Paranoid blockages, as well as schizophrenic lack of constraint, annihilate time. According to Hart and Negri, globalization has developed two opposing forces. On the one hand, it creates empire, which establishes a decentralized, deterritorialized capitalist regime through constant control and perpetual conflict. On the other hand, it produces a multitude, a body of singularities that communicate with each other via a network and act collectively. The multitude opposes empire from within empire. So Hart and Negri have revamped class struggle. The violence generated by empire is interpreted as the violence of exploiting the other. The multitude is the real productive force of our social world, whereas empire is a mere apparatus of capture that lives only off the vitality of the multitude, as Marx would say, a vampire regime of accumulated dead labor that survives only by sucking off the blood of the living. Hart and Negri play too little consideration to political economic realities, constructing their theoretical models on the basis of historically obsolete categories like class or class struggle. They define the multitude as class. One initial approach is to conceive the multitude as all those who work under the rule of capital, and thus potentially as the class of those who refuse the rule of capital. This talk of class only makes sense in the context of a plurality of classes that interact or compete with each other. But the multitude is basically the only class. After all, everyone who is a part of the capitalist system belongs to it. It has no ruling class to struggle against. In empire, everyone is subjugated to the imperatives of the capitalist economy. Empire is not a ruling class that exploits the multitude as proletariat. Rather, the multitude exploits itself. Negri and Hart do not recognize this self-exploitation. In empire, no one really rules. It represents the capitalist system, which encompasses everyone. Exploitation of the other does take place within it, but the basic method for maintaining the system is self-exploitation. As Hart and Negri themselves realize, class is and can only be a collectivity that struggles in common. Class requires an intense sense of belonging, which is the motivation for collective action. But contemporary society is characterized by the universal disappearance of this sense of belonging, of a we. And political apathy and indifference paired with increasing infantilization of society make collective action very unlikely. The globalized world is not populated by singularities committed to collective resistance against empire, but rather by isolated and mutually antagonistic selves. Everyone involved in the capitalist production process is simultaneously victim and perpetrator. When the perpetrator and victim are one, no resistance is possible. Hart and Negri miss this particular topology of the global. Social power arises only through collective action, from a we, but the egoification and atomization of society radically shrink the space available for collective action, hindering the formation of a counterforce that could truly challenge the capitalist order. Sosius gives way to solace. It is not multitude, but solitude that typifies contemporary social composition. Isolation doesn't generate power. Hart and Negri fail to take this social development into account, even pursuing an imaginary discourse that augurs a romantic communist revolution by the multitude. The lack of a counterforce perpetuates the neoliberal economic order. It develops a strong appropriative energy which absorbs everything and converts it into capitalist formula. After the fall of communism, capitalism no longer had an exterior that could jeopardize it in earnest. Even Islamic terrorism is not a manifestation of an equally matched base of power that could truly threaten the capitalist system. Capitalism can even absorb it and transform it into stabilizing systemic energies. Only an implosion of the system through overheating and overloading is conceivable. This implosive violence differs from explosive violence, which expands and conquers new territories through the violence of classic warfare. Explosive violence creates pressure outward. Owing to the lack of an exterior, implosive violence pushes inward. Destructive tension and warping grow inside, causing the system to collapse into itself. Now, I'm just thinking about this, as a reader's note, in terms of the pandemic, and if it's possible that, I mean, not to be an accelerationist or anything, but if it is possible that we could see capitalism start to short circuit because of this globalized issue, and, you know, what might come next from this. But who knows? Just theory, you know? Violent conflicts taking place all over the world but lacking any solidarity are indiscriminately interpreted as a war against empire by Hart and Negri. In reality, these conflicts don't necessarily have anything to do with neoliberalism. The violent conflicts listed by Hart and Negri themselves do not point to any ideological solidarity or communal goal. The student revolt in Tiananmen Square, the radical unrest in Los Angeles in 1992, the Intifada, the uprisings in Chiapas, the rail strikes in France. But Hart and Negri themselves realize that no communication takes place between these struggles for resistance, which have neither a common language nor a common enemy. But that does not lead them to recognize the insufficiency of their own thesis. Without communication, there obviously cannot be any collective action, that is, any counterforce. Hart and Negri simply impute a non-existent communal intention to them. Lack of communication, they conjecture, is a new type of communication, a communication of singularities. The struggles for resistance do not link horizontally. Rather, each individual one leaps vertically, directly to the virtual center of empire. Hart and Negri argue counterfactually. In fact, society today is gripped by a general process of decline of the social, the common, and the communal. It is atomizing and particularizing noticeably. Contrary to this factual development comes the claim that the essence of contemporary production relations consists in constructing cooperation and communicative commonalities, which would lead to a crisis of private property. The concept of private property itself, understood as the exclusive right to use a good and dispose of all wealth that derives from the possession of it, becomes increasingly nonsensical. Contrary to their conclusion today, the communal is in a state of increasing decline. Nothing is sacred to the expanding privatization. The decline of the communal makes collective action ever less likely. Hart and Negri overestimate the strength of the resistance against the capitalist neoliberal system. It is inherent in its constitution that the exploiters and the exploited are difficult to tell apart, and that perpetrator and victim merge together. Now, I guess, like, I would take a note here and just say, like, we clearly have, like, a neo-techno-feudalist society developing where I think our enemies are pretty clearly, like, Jeff Bezos and his ilk. So, I guess I would just make that note. Yeah. No unambiguous opposition forms no clear front that would require two separate camps, forces, or classes. This particular topology of violence escapes Hart and Negri completely. They observe, although exploitation and domination are still experienced concretely on the flesh of the multitude, they are nonetheless amorphous in such a way that it seems there is no place left to hide. If there is no longer a place that can be recognized as outside, we must be against in every place. We must be against in every place, and yet it is unclear what it is we are resisting. And so the fictive determination of the multitude peters out into nothing. Hart and Negri apparently do not recognize that in Empire, combatants soon prove to be collaborators. Violence and exploitation are no longer counterparts because everyone exploits themselves. The perpetrator is also the victim. Exploitation by others gives way to self-exploitation. This exploitation takes place without domination because it is performed in the name of freedom. Any counterpart that could be combated frontally is erased by this imminent violence. I guess it's just kind of is reminding me of, like, the protests to open back up the economy and the way that the people who are protesting can be seen as victims, but also seen as the perpetrators victimizing the people that they want to exploit to work for them. I don't know. The global capitalist neoliberal system, which Hart and Negri call empire, is actually the conflict-ridden interior of the world in which the human race wages war with itself. The war is total because it fuses completely with social relations and presents itself as freedom. The distant roar of battle that Foucault once heard sounding from disciplinary institutions has established itself as the keynote of society. War extends into the soul of every individual. One doesn't wage it against others, but above all, with oneself. In the face of this totality and imminence of war, classic resistance, which assumes a clear separation of interior and exterior, friend and enemy, rulership and subjugation, tilts at windmills. The only possible way to oppose empire would be to mitigate the process that creates it, eliminating its diabolic sting. But the strategy that Hart and Negri suggest would be problematic. They are of the opinion that it is neither possible nor desirable to reverse the process. Rather, it must be accelerated and intensified. Thus they invoke Deleuze and Guattari. Deleuze and Guattari argued that, rather than resist capital's globalization, we have to accelerate the process. But which, they ask, is the revolutionary path? To withdraw from the world market? Or might it be to go in the opposite direction? To go still further, that is, in the movement of the market, of decoding and deterritorialization? Empire can be effectively contested only on its own level of generality and by pushing the process that it offers past their present limitations. And I guess I would want to point to some reference of this acceleration in the commentary that Nick Land put out about his cancellation by the left, and saying that he, you know, was noticing that one of the ways that the left is actually going to be able to reconfigure itself is through an adoption of these, of more humanist properties, instead of strictly looking at acceleration through a lens of a right-wing potential to just facilitate the market. I think that if looking at the pandemic, like the way that that is sort of affecting our global economy and the way that capitalism is seeing itself actually start to unravel, it might be true. You know, we are turning more into like a feudal society in some respects, which is terrifying, but we are also seeing a lot of shifts and possibilities for people who can understand their class consciousness as opposing certain ruling class interests, like, we might be able to make some ground here. It would be devastating to go further and with more determination into the movement of the market and of capital. The world and the world market are not identical. The total commercialization of the world would be its violation. Commercialization represses and obliterates everything that isn't work, profit, capital, efficiency, and performance. The hysteria for production and performance and the hypertension of competition produce pathological symptoms of various kinds. The hypermobility of the global is like a total mobilization that poses as a peace accord. The attempt to accelerate and intensify the dynamic processes that govern empire beyond their current dimensions would have catastrophic consequences. Total burnout of the system would then be unavoidable. The state of exception is a state of extreme negativity because all positive forms are suspended within it. It ensues that the moment in which an exterior punctures the interior of a system and challenges its entirety. A negative tension between the interior and the exterior is essential for the state of exception. It confronts the immanence of a system with the transcendence of another, which threatens it. The negativity of the completely other induces a contraction within the system, causing it to quake. The establishment of the state of exception is a system's immunological reaction to a threat from the exterior. The sovereign commands absolute power to suspend the current legal system. He embodies legislative power and violence, which maintains a relation to the legal order even outside it. Thus, the sovereign need not be right in order to determine rights. By suspending the current legal order, the state of exception produces a lawless space in which absolute access to every individual is possible. Oh, God. I'm just thinking about the way that Palantir is being offered these possibilities to manage contact tracing. And thus giving access to all individuals to a company that is known for contact tracing to eliminate what they would deem terrorist organizations. But, you know, of course, it's just for public health. So, you know, let's see if the law can step in at any point. According to Agamben, human life is only politicized by its inclusion in the power of sovereignty, that is, only through an abandonment to an unconditional power of death. Bare mortal life and the power of sovereignty produce each other. Contrary to our modern habit of representing the political realm in terms of citizens' rights, free will, and social contracts from the point of view of sovereignty, only bare life is authentically political. Life exposed to death is the originary political element. The erpanomen of politics is banishment, which produces the bare life of homo sacer. Sovereignty and the bare life of homo sacer both stand at the outer limits of a system. In the eyes of the sovereign, all people are potential homines sacri. The fascination that Agamben's theory of sovereignty exerted doesn't attest to the fact that today the state of exception threatens to become the norm, as Agamben claims. To the contrary, it points to the fact that we now live in a society governed by an excess of positivity, in which a state of exception is no longer possible. We often are fascinated by things that are on the brink of disappearing. The state of exception is a state of negativity. It is only possible given an intrusion of the other or exterior. The positivization of society totalizes the normative state today by stripping it of all negativity and transcendence. It totalizes the interior, obliterating any exterior. Terror is produced not only by the transcendence of sovereignty, but also by immanence. The terror of positivity might possibly be more catastrophic than the terror of negativity because it evades immune defense. The society of sovereignty has long belonged to the past. Today, no one is politicized through an abandonment to an unconditional power of death. There is no longer any exterior, no transcendence, no sovereignty of power to which one would be subjugated and exposed as an obedient subject. Contemporary society is not a society of sovereignty. We now live in a society of achievement. The achievement subject differs from the obedient subject in that it is the sovereign of itself, as the entrepreneur of itself. It is free. The achievement subject is free from external authorities that would force it to work and exploit it. It is subjugated to no one, or only to itself. The loss of an external authority doesn't do away with the structure of compulsion. Freedom and compulsion merge. The achievement subject devotes itself to the free compulsion for maximizing performance. It exploits itself. Self-exploitation is more efficient than exploitation by the other because it is accompanied by a misleading sense of freedom. The exploiter is also the exploited. In this case, exploitation takes place without domination. That is what makes self-exploitation so efficient. The capitalist system shifts from exploitation by the other to self-exploitation, from should to can, all in order to accelerate. As a result of its paradoxical freedom, the achievement subject is at once perpetrator and victim, master and slave. Here, freedom and violence are indistinguishable. The achievement subject, which pretends to be sovereign of itself, homo liber, proves to be homo sacer. Sovereign of achievement society is at the same time the homo sacer of itself. Paradoxically, in the society of achievement, the sovereign and homo sacer also produce each other, but they are identical. That is the difference between reality and Agamben's theory of sovereignty. And I guess here it's kind of like, obviously we understand that people live in different material circumstances, and, you know, there are different ways to look at the way that there is a lot of coercion going on still in the structures of our society when you look at, like, police states and everything. But I think this is most specifically talking about the way that we are... the way that we are educated and the way that capitalism, you know, reproduces its own, you know, functions and how we kind of play into it. Not, you know, we don't necessarily have to, but that would mean if we don't participate in capitalism, we end up, you know, killing ourselves. So it's like, you know, you're tricked into believing that you're doing a capitalism because you're a real achievement subject, and you're really making the rounds and you're really hustling. But really there isn't much choice behind it. And especially now, you know, in a time when we're all so isolated and we only have the choice to keep applying for these relief programs that may or may not come in, and, you know, if they don't, we don't really have anyone to hold accountable directly, unless we find some way towards national and international solidarity of workers' movements, and we'll see how that goes with the rent strike. I mean, I put my chips down on it. Agamben adheres to the principle of negativity. In it, perpetrator and victim, sovereign and homo sacer, are clearly distinguished, also topologically. Sovereignty and the bare life of homo sacer both stand at the outer limits of a system. Agamben's state of exception is a state of negativity. The homines sacrae of achievement society, in contrast, live in a totalized state of normality, which is a state of positivity. Agamben completely misses the topological shift of violence that is the basis for the shift from the society of sovereignty to the society of achievement. The achievement society is characterized by the violence of positivity, which evades the immunological paradigm of negativity to which Agamben consistently adheres. Muslim is a slang term for prisoners of a concentration camp who are completely enfeebled, emaciated, and apathetic. As hominis sacrae of a totalitarian society, they are the outermost edge of an order in a non-place. As the late modern Homo sacer, the achievement subject is centrally located, directly at the center of an order. Labor camps also are no longer located on the outskirts. Rather, every achievement subject carries the camp with it. Now, I think that's like a real hyperbole, but whatever. in a certain sense, I guess I understand that as like, you know, we have to work or we will die because we don't have a system that takes care of people. The center becomes indistinguishable from a non-place. The achievement subject is prisoner and warden at once. It cannot defend itself from this violence because it is committed by itself. One has the creeping suspicion that the late modern achievement subject, with its psychic disorders like burnout and depression, as a Muslim itself. The history of violence culminates in this merging of victim and perpetrator, of master and slave, of freedom and violence. When Agamben notes that we all may possibly be virtual homines sacri, it is because we are all subject to sovereign banishment and absolute mortality. Agamben's social diagnosis contradicts all elements of contemporary society, which is no longer a society of sovereignty. The banishment that has made homines sacri of all of us today is not the banishment of sovereignty, but rather the banishment of achievement. The achievement subject considers itself to be free. As homo liber, sovereign of itself, it is now subject to the banishment of achievement, turning itself into homo sacer. The sovereign of the achievement society is the homo sacer of itself. Ehrenberg's theory of depression overlooks the systemic violence that is inherent in achievement society. Large portions of his analysis are psychologically and not economically or politically based. As a result, he doesn't recognize the capitalist relation of self-exploitation in the achievement subject's disorders. According to Ehrenberg, depression arises only from the imperative to belong to oneself. Depression is the pathological expression of the failure of the late modern subject to become itself. Ehrenberg equates with Nietzsche's sovereign man without recognizing that it is sovereign and homo sacer at once. For Nietzsche, it wouldn't be the sovereign man, but rather the last man who exploits himself as his own slave. Contrary to Ehrenberg's assumption, Nietzsche's sovereign man is actually a culturally critical countermodel to the exhausted, depressive achievement subject. Thus, he is presented as a man of leisure. Nietzsche would find hyperactivity repugnant. The strong soul conserves its peace, moves slowly, and feels repugnance at the all too lively. In Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche writes, "All of you who are in love with hectic work and whatever is fast, new, strange, you find it hard to bear yourselves. Your diligence is escape and the will to forget yourself. If you believed more in life, you would hurl yourself less into the moment. But you do not have enough content in yourself for waiting, not even for laziness." For Agamben, the power of sovereignty produces the sphere in which one can kill without committing murder. Life is sacred, sacer, when it is enclosed in this sphere of sovereignty. The sacredness of life originally meant an unconditional subjection to a power of death. The production of the bare life of Homo sacer is originally the work of sovereignty. Homo sacer's life is bare because it exists outside the legal order and therefore can be killed at any time. The life of Homo sacer of the Achievement Society is sacred and bare for entirely different reasons. It is bare because it has been stripped of any transcendence of value, reduced to the imminence of the vital functions and performance which must be maximized with all available means. Through its own inner logic, the Achievement Society develops into a doping society. Life reduced to its bare vital functions is a life that must be kept healthy at any cost. Health is the new goddess of today. It is what makes bare life sacred. the hominis sacri of the Achievement Society have another characteristic that sets them apart from those of the Society of Sovereignty. They are impossible to kill. Their lives are like those of the undead. They are too alive to die and too dead to live. Well, and that concludes the reading. I hope that everyone is staying healthy out there and staying too alive to die, but not because of any structure of control, simply because it's worth it to stay alive so that we can fight another day. Anyway, everybody, you know, send thoughts and prayers out to people who are fighting with their landlords right now, people who are struggling in essential services, and everyone who's just trying to figure out how to get this general strike popping. You know, we don't have to be as atomized as we are. It's simply a product of our contemporary neoliberal society that's happening. So, peace out, homies, and let's have fun.
Lots of fun.